Chapter 7. No Dutchman from the Texel or the Skelt came out to meet the Ariel, nor did she encounter any privateers. But the Danes had never cordially loved the Royal Navy since the bombardments of their capital and the taking of their fleet. Danger lay ahead, and the little ship proceeded on her way, daily more prepared to meet it. To his satisfaction, Jack found that he had inherited a better ship's company than he had expected. The gunner had served under Broke, learning his trade in the old Druid. Two of his mates had belonged to the Surprise when Jack had her, and although Draper, his predecessor, had been unwilling or unable to spend much on powder and shot, he had at least fitted locks and sights to the 9-pounders, while his officers, a decent average set of young men, were perfectly willing to enter into their new captain's notion of the standard of gunnery proper to a king's ship. The Ariel sailed north, therefore, in an often renewed cloud of her own smoke, thundering by day and night, odd, unexpected intervals being the best training for an emergency, and although Jack could not hope for the speed he had achieved in long commissions, nor anything like the accuracy, apart from all other considerations his short carronades were incapable of throwing a ball with the precision of a long gun, he was pleased with the result so far, and confident that the Ariel would do herself credit if she were to meet with a fair match. Indeed, he longed for such an action, not only because of his natural love of battle, of the immense exhilaration, the magnifying of life, but because the Ariels, though a fairly good crew, were made up of 3 recent drafts, and they did not form a whole. All through his naval life he had observed the attachment, even the affection, that sprang up between men who had been through a serious sea fight together, and the very valuable change in the relationship between the hands and the officers, a change that worked both ways. For example, there was a bond between him and Rakes and Harris, the gunner's mates, because they had all 3 been mauled by a French ship of the line in the Indian Ocean. Naval custom ruled out much in the way of conversation between them, but the special relationship, the esteem, was most certainly there.
"This is more like a proper life for a man," he observed to Stephen, after one of these exercises had caused the Heligoland Bight to ring again.
"Sure, even the complexity of a vessel with as many masts as this, with all their ropes and the nice adjustment of their dependent sails, is nothing to the difficulties of life ashore," replied Stephen, pulling up his collar.
He had always noticed that Jack was quite another man at sea, a bigger man, capable of dealing both with strange, surprising situations and the common daily round, and usually a happier one. But he had rarely seen the change so strongly marked before. A bitter drizzle was sweeping down from the North Frisian Islands. A short cross sea kept sending irregular dashes of spray across the windward side of the quarterdeck, and Jack's face rose above his inadequate, hastily purchased pea jacket, streaming with wet, but beaming like a somewhat battered rising sun.
"Perhaps to some degree it may lie in the autumnal simplicity of our diet, a diet produced by no effort of our own and served up at stated intervals, whereas on land food is a frequent subject of consideration, and the gastric juices are therefore perpetually solicited. But no doubt a more important factor on shore is the presence of an entirely different sex, of the excitation of other appetites, and of the appearance of a whole new set of social and even moral values."
"Why, as to that," said Jack,
but he was peering and craning to see the foretopmast cross-trees, and for the moment his mind was elsewhere.
"Mr. Rowbottom,"
he called to a midshipman on the leeward side,
"jump up to the foretopmast cross-trees and tell Mr. Yagiello, with my compliments, that I would like to speak to him when he is at leisure. And harkee, Mr. Rowbottom, he is to come down through the lubber's hole, do you hear me? There is to be no skylarking, no sliding down the backstays."
"No, sir. Yes, sir," said Rowbottom, and shot into the rigging with a speed, if not the grace, of his cousin the ring-tailed lemur.
"I beg your pardon," said Jack, "but I really cannot have him wandering aloft like that, above all with his wounded hand. He is an unlucky wight, and will certainly break his neck."
It was true. Yagiello had already taken advantage of a temporary gap in the hammock netting to fall into the sea, from which he had been plucked, laughing heartily, by a well-aimed log-line. and of the only time a hatchway had ever been left uncovered to plunge into the hold, where nothing but a heap of empty sacks preserved him, and he had very, very nearly been destroyed when Awkward Moses dropped the mizzen-to-gallant-mast Fid just between his feet from such a height that the massive piece of iron stuck in the deck like a bar shot, while only yesterday the lock of a 9-pounder had slipped its sear when he was being shown the mechanism, almost severing one finger and pinching the rest most cruelly. He was a popular figure aboard. The hands liked him not only because he had begged Awkward Moses off his flogging, but also because he was always cheerful, and apparently quite devoid of fear. The gunroom liked him because he was good company, attentive to their anecdotes and appreciative of their wit. The stupider officers, like Mr. Hyde, still addressed him in a loud, slow, barbarous jargon calculated for half-witted children and foreigners, but Graham the surgeon, a reading man when he was sober, and Fenton, the second lieutenant, maintained that it was great nonsense to say, "Im called dog's body. 'Tis peas puddin' really, but we say dog's body. You like im, dog's body?" to a man who could play such a hand at whist and beat all comers at the chessboard, and in both cases his absurd beauty and an indefinable sweetness of manner no doubt had their effect.
"Ah, Mr. Yegyello," said Jack, "how kind of you to come. I wanted to ask you in the first place whether you would favour us with your company at dinner. I'm also asking Mr. Hyde, and in the second whether you have any military connections in the town of Gothenburg. A lower tier of powder proves sadly damp, and I should very much like to replace it."
"I should be very happy, sir," said Yagyello. "Thank you very much. And as for Gothenburg, I know the commandant. I am sure he will be delighted to give you powder, all the more since his mother is a Scotch."
Stephen had spoken of the simplicity of their diet, and the captain's dinner was a fair example of it. Apart from the marine glue, flavoured with sherry and thickened with crushed biscuit, that began the feast, and a dwarfish fowl which Stephen carefully divided into four wizened pieces that tasted of tar, and some of yesterday's dried peas boiled in a cloth until they merged into a homogeneous mass, it was exactly the same salt horse and biscuit that had nourished the gunroom, the midshipmen's berth, and the mess deck a little earlier in the day, for the Ariel, hurried so untimely to sea, had not had the leisure to lay in private stores. What little she had left had been devoured before she reached 54 degrees north, and now all hands would have to be content with what the victualling office allowed them, at least until they reached Swedish waters.
"Perhaps you would be so kind as to cut up Mr. Yegyello's beef for him," said Jack to Mr. Hyde, nodding at his guest's bandaged hands.
"By all means, sir," cried the lieutenant, and he set to his laborious task.
The beef had been to the West Indies and back, and now, in its raw state, it could be carved and filed into durable ornaments, and even after some hours in the steep tubs and the galley copper, it still retained something of its heart of oak. Stephen noticed that Hyde was left-handed, which gave him an awkward air, but his left hand was obviously powerful, obviously used to salt horse, and using immense pressure he was dividing the lump into reasonable gobbets. As he did so, he said to Yegyello in an undertone,
"I hope him no hurt too much."
"You are very good, sir," replied Yegyello. "It is nothing at all. I must confess that this morning I found a little inconvenience in shaving and in putting on my pea-jacket, but Dr. Maturin," bowing to Stephen, "and Dr. Graham—"
Here the beef shot into Jack's bosom with surprising force. It was in vain that they laughed. It was in vain that Jack told Hyde he should certainly be hanged for directing a lethal weapon at a superior officer. The poor man could scarcely smile, and when, the meal having begun again, he passed the peas pudding to Yagyello, saying,
"A little god's body, sir? Dog's body, I mean?"
he did so in a low and melancholy voice. This was not the first time that Stephen had noticed Hyde's tendency to displace letters, and he wondered whether it might be connected with his left-handedness, whether the confusion of right and left, and he had seen Hyde pass the port the wrong way round, might not be related to the inversion of sounds, particularly at a time when the mind itself was confused. He did not pursue the reflection, however, but said,
"A little while ago we were speaking of sex. But now I come to think of it, Perhaps this is not a proper subject for the captain's table, from which politics and religion are excluded, a subject laudable on the deck but forbidden below it?"
"I believe I have known it raised at table," said Jack.
"It was the sense of freedom and of simplification that prompted my observation. In this ark, this floating community, we are all of the same sex. What would be the effect if our numbers were evenly divided between the two, as it is the case on land?" He addressed himself more particularly to Jagiello, who blushed and said he could not tell. "I know very little of women, sir," he said. "You cannot make friends with them. They are the hues of the world."
"Hues, Mr. Jagiello?"
cried Jack. And to himself, chuckling much, he added,
"It would be a damned odd thing if they proved rams, you know."
"Jews, I mean," said Jagiello. "You cannot make friends with Jews. They have been beaten and spitted on so long they are the enemy, like the laconical helots, and women have been domestical helots for so much longer. There is no friendship between enemies, even in a truce. They are always watching. And if you are not friends, where is the real knowledge?"
"Some speak of love," suggested Stephen.
"Love!" cried the young man. "But love is a creature of time, whereas friendship is not. Your own Shakespeare says—"
The sailors never learnt what their own Shakespeare said, because a midshipman sent by the officer of the watch came to say that the weather, lifting to leeward, had disclosed 28 sail of merchantmen, together with a frigate and a brig, thought to be Melampus and Dryad.
"A Baltic convoy, for sure," said Jack. "No one could mistake Melampus. But still, I think we may as well have a look. Doctor, will you entertain Mr. Jagiello with reasons until we come back? I have great hopes we may finish our dinner with something better than condemned Essex cheese."
"Mr. Jagiello," said Stephen when they had gone, "I should like to ask you about the ancient gods of Lithuania, which, I understand, still lead a ghostly life among your boars, about the worship of oak trees, the white-tailed eagle, and the Plica polonica, the beaver, the mink, and the wizened or European bison. But first, before it should slip my mind, I must tell you I am charged with a message to be delivered in a most tactful, diplomatic way, so that it does not in the least resemble an order, so improper to a guest, but so that it shall have an equivalent force and effect. Your agility in the upper rigging excites wonder and admiration, my dear sir, but at the same time it causes a very great uneasiness of mind, an uneasiness proportionable to the esteem in which you are held, and it would please the captain if you would confine yourself to the lower platforms, technically known as tops.
Does he believe that I shall fall?
He believes that laws of gravity bear more severely on soldiers than on seamen, and since you are a hussar, he is convinced that you will fall. I shall do as he wishes, of course. But he is mistaken, you know. Heroes never fall, at least not fatally. I was not aware that you were a hero, Mr. Jagiello.
The Ariel took on a surprising lean as she brought the stiff breeze abaft the beam, set her t'gallants and weather stunsails, and dashed down on the Melampus at a good 10 knots, her lee rail buried in the foam. Jagiello had a good hold on the table, but a lee lurch unseated him and he slid to the deck, where for a moment his spurs, caught in the matting, held him prisoner.
"Of course I am a hero," he said, getting up and laughing very cheerfully. "Every man is a hero of his own tale. Surely, Dr. Maturin, every man must look on himself as wiser and more intelligent and more virtuous than the rest. So how could he see himself as the villain, or even as a minor character? And you must have noticed that heroes are never beaten. They may be undone for a while, but they always do themselves up again and marry the virtuous young gentlewoman."
"I have noticed it, indeed. There are some eminent exceptions, sure, but upon the whole I am convinced you are right. Perhaps it is that which makes your novel, or tale, a little tedious."
"Ah, Dr. Maturin," cried Jagiello, "if I could find an Amazon, one of a tribe of women that never have been oppressed, one that I could be friends with, equal friends, oh, how I should love her! Alas, my dear, men destroyed the last Amazon 2,000 years ago, and I fear your heart must go virgin to the grave.
What is that noise? Like bears on the roof? Asked Jagiello, breaking off.
It is the launching of a boat, and from the howling of the mariners I collect that it will be some time before we see our dessert. What say you to a game of chess while we are waiting? It may be no conclusive test of our relative wisdom, virtue, or intelligence, but I can think of no better.
With all my heart, said Jagiello. But if I lose, you are not to suppose that it will make the least difference to my conviction.
The game might not prove much about the intelligence of the players, but it provided certain evidence that Jagiello's virtue, or at least his kindness, was greater than Stephen's. Stephen, playing to win, had launched a powerful attack on the Queen's side. He had launched it one move too early. A vile pawn still masked his heavy artillery, and now Jagiello was wondering how he could play to lose, how he could make a mistake that should not be woundingly obvious to his opponent. Jagiello's chess was far beyond Stephen's. His power of dissembling his emotions was not, and Stephen was watching his expression of ill-assumed stupidity with some amusement when the boat was heard to return. A moment later, Jack came in, followed by his steward, bearing a plum cake the size of a moderate cartwheel, and by two powerful hands, with a hamper that clanked glassy as they set it down, while the pitter of hoofs overhead and a melancholy baa told of the presence of at least one devoted sheep. Jagiello, with a look of relief, instantly moved the board to make room for the cake, solving his problem by upsetting all the pieces.
"I am sorry to have been so tedious long," said Jack, "but I'm sure you will find it worth the wait. Melampus has always done herself as proud as the mansion house. Cut and come again, Mr. Jagiello. This only has to last us until Gothenburg."
Gothenburg, a melancholy town, most of it quite recently burned, inhabited by tall, spare melancholiacs dressed in grey wool, much given to drinking and self-murder. The river brought three suicides past the Ariel during her brief stay, but kind to strangers if not to themselves. The Commandant at once provided powder, best red-letter cylinder powder, together with a present of smoked reindeer's tongues and a barrel of salted honey buzzards. These he gave to Stephen, saying,
"Pray, accept this small keg of buzzards."
"Buzzards, my dear sir?" cried Stephen, startled from his usual calm.
"Oh, not common buzzards," said the Commandant, "nor half-legged buzzards. You need not be afraid. They are all honey buzzards, I do assure you."
"I am fully persuaded of it, sir, and return my best thanks," said Stephen. "May I ask how they came there?" he added, looking attentively at the cask.
"I put them there myself," said the Commandant with pride. "I put them there with my own hands, choosing each one. Fine plump birds, though I should not say it."
"Did you shoot them, sir?"
"Oh, no," said the Commandant, quite shocked. "You must never shoot a honey buzzard. It ruins the flavour. No, we strangle them."
"Do they not resent this?"
"I think not," said the Commandant. "It happens at night. I have a small house at Falsterbo, a peninsula at the far end of the sound with a few trees upon it. Here the birds come in the autumn, myriads of birds flying south, and great numbers roost in the wood, so many you may scarcely see the trees. We choose the best, pluck them down, and so strangle them. It has been done for ever. All the best salted buzzards come from Falsterbo, and no doubt they are used to it."
"Do eagles also appear, sir?" asked Stephen.
Oh, yes, indeed. Do you salt them, too?" "Oh, no," said the Commandant, amused. "A salted eagle would be a very whimsical dish. They are always pickled, you know, otherwise they would eat intolerably dry."
While the powder was coming aboard, Stephen said,
"How I should like to see this Falsterbo."
"Perhaps you will," said Jack. "The Commandant tells me the Danes are very thick on the ground in the belt. Melampus said the same. And I have a great mind to run through the sound. Let us have a word with the pilot." "Mr. Pellworm," said he, when the Baltic pilot came in, an ancient man, Jack's old and highly respected acquaintance.
"Mr. Pellworm, I have a great mind to run through the sound. I know the Danes have shifted their buoys, but do you think you could take her through the narrows in the night, the tail end of the night?"
"Man and boy," said Mr. Pellworm, Man and boy, I threaded the sound till I know it like the back of my hand. Like the back of my hand, sir. I do not need their old sea marks to take a ship of Ariel's draught through the narrows in the night, or right down to Falsterbo, for that matter, with the Swedish lights.
And what do you think of the wind, Mr. Pellworm?
Why, sir, at this time of the year we always say, in by the sound, out by the belt, because the westerlies always hang a little north in the one and a little south in the other. Never you fear for the wind, sir. It will stand fair for the sound these next 3 or 4 days, or I am a Dutchman.
Then let it be so, Mr. Pellworm. We will weigh the moment the powder hoy casts off, and that will get us through the narrows in the darkness.
The pilot was no Dutchman as far as the wind's direction was concerned. To begin with, it carried the Ariel down the Kattegat at a fine, brisk pace. But he was mistaken as to its force. In the middle watch, Jack stirred from his sleep, listened to the song of the water along the ship's side, put a jacket over his nightshirt, and went on deck. Diffused moonlight, a quiet black sea, and the Ariel slipping along under all plain sail. Perhaps 5 knots, certainly not more. Far out on the larboard bow, a light on the Swedish shore. Surely it could not be the Kullen. Surely the Kullen must be well astern by now. He stepped over to the binnacle, took the logboard with its chalked record of wind, course, and speed, and quickly worked out his position. Yes, it was certainly the Kullen. The pilot came over to him and coughed apologetically.
"May I have the watch below to make more sail, sir?"
he asked.
"No," said Jack. "It is not worth it. Let us wait until 8 bells."
They were sadly behind their time, but it was not worth calling all hands now. Even with royals, skyscrapers, and stunsails aloft and alow, they would still have to pass the narrows in the daylight.
Mr. Jevons, is it not?"
he said to a muffled midshipman in the dimness.
"Pray go below and fetch my boat cloak. It is hanging by the barometer, and take great care not to wake the doctor."
Wrapped in his cloak, he stood by the stern lantern, watching the sky and the ship, and considering his course of action. Upon the whole, he thought he should carry on rather than go round by the belt. The danger was not very great, and the saving of time outweighed it. What he really disliked about this late passage was that the Danish gunboats from Copenhagen and Saltholm would be perfectly ready for him, the news having run ahead, and that, if it were to fall flat calm, might be unpleasant. They were an enterprising lot, and they had already captured a number of sloops and brigs of war. However, he thought he should carry on. And while he turned this over in his mind, he also reflected upon some aspects of life at sea and the unvarying routine he had known in every ship he had sailed in. A harsh, cold, uncomfortable, demanding routine often enough, but one that did at least bring order out of chaos. An acknowledged framework, commandments from on high, sometimes arbitrary, sometimes archaic, but generally workable and always more immediate, more obviously enforced than the Decalogue. An infinity of problems within that framework, of course, but the order provided answers to most of them, or cut them short with sudden death. 7 bells, and from all round the ship there came the cry, "All's well!" 8 bells, and while the frowsy larbolens were being mustered, warm, pink, and unwashed from their hammocks, the mate of the watch heaved the log.
"Turn!"
cried the mate. 28 seconds later,
"Nip!"
cried the quartermaster.
"What have you?"
called Jack.
4 knots and 3 fathoms, sir, if you please," replied Mr. Fenton.
It was much as he had thought, a steady decline. Still, he could always creep along under the Swedish batteries, or even put into Helsingborg. While both watches were on deck, he gave orders to make more sail and return to his meditation. The eastern sky was lightening, and already the ritual of washing the almost spotless deck was well in hand. The pumps were wheezing round, all was awash, and Jack went below to put on some clothes and get out of the main topman's way as they moved aft with buckets, sand, holy stones, and swabs. The Ariel was a very little ship, but she did her commander proud. As well as his great cabin, he had 2 little booths opening off it, his sleeping and dining cabins, and seeing that neither was encumbered with guns, Ariel being flush-decked, there was just enough room in each to sling a cot. It put Stephen into one, moving the dining table aft, and at this table he now sat, comfortably enough, until the rhythmical beating of swabs told him that the deck, unnecessarily washed, had now been unnecessarily dried. He returned to his place, there watching the steady progress of the ship's exactly ordered life, the unfolding promise of the day, scanning the clouds for the probable behaviour of the wind, and watching the coast move slowly, very slowly, by. He was still there when Stephen appeared, unusually early for him, carrying a borrowed telescope.
"Good morning, Jack," he said,
and then, staring about him,
"Mother of God! It is narrower than I had supposed."
Narrow it was. On the shore to larboard walked Swedes, clearly to be seen in the bright sunlight, and on that to starboard, Danes. 3 miles of sea between them, and the aerial in about the middle, rather nearer the Swedish side, creeping south with little more than steerage way upon her.
"Have you seen them yet?" he asked.
"Have I seen what?"
"Why, the eider ducks, of course. Do you not remember that Jagiello promised us eider ducks in the Sound? I had thought that was what you were looking at so earnestly."
"So he did. But I've not really been attending. Still, I believe I can show you something that will please you even more. Do you see those green roofs and terraces? That is Elsinore."
"Elsinore itself? The very Elsinore? God bless my soul. And yours too, Joy. A noble pile. I view it with reverence. I had supposed it to be merely ideal. Hush, do not move. They come! They come!"
A flight of duck wheeled overhead, large, powerful, heavy, swift-flying duck in files, and pitched between the castle and the ship.
"Eiders, without a doubt," said Stephen, his telescope fixed upon them. "They are mostly young, but there on the right is a drake in full dress. He dives. I see his black belly. This is a day to mark with a white stone."
A great jet of white water sprang from the surface of the sea. The eiders vanished.
"Good God!" he cried, staring in amazement. "What was that?"
"They have opened on us with their mortars," said Jack. "That was what I was looking for."
A puff of smoke appeared on the nearer terrace, and half a minute later a second fountain rose 200 yards short of the aerial.
"The Goths!" cried Stephen, glaring angrily at Elsinore. "They might have hit the birds! These Danes have always been a very froward people. Do you know, Jack, what they did at Clonmacnoise? They burnt it, the thieves, and their queen sat on the high altar, mother naked, uttering oracles in a heathen frenzy. Ota was the strumpet's name. It is all of a piece. Look at Hamlet's mother. I only wonder her behaviour caused any comment."
The next shot pitched well over the aerial, sending up its plume a cable's length to larboard. Jack took the telescope and trained it on the battery. 5 whiffs of smoke that drifted away down the sound. 5 fountains in the sea, 3 beyond, 2 short, and the long, sullen roar.
"Tolerably good practice," he observed. "They are increasing their charge."
The pilot came aft and said,
"Shall I put you into Helsingborg, sir?"
"No,"
said Jack, glancing at the Swedish port a little abaft the larboard beam.
"Carry on down the sound, Mr. Pelworm. You may shave the Swedish shore as close as you please, however."
And to Stephen he said,
"Tossing a 200-pound bombshell at a moving object is a chancy business at this range, you know. A hit-or-miss affair. Nothing like lobbing them into a fortification or an anchored fleet. And they have just as much chance of hitting us if we put back as if we stand on. Indeed, rather more, since we should be going from them in a right line. Mr. Jagiello, good morning to you. The Danes are busy, as you see."
"I wish they may burst," said Jagiello. "Good morning, sir. Doctor, your servant."
A group of 3 shells directly in the aerial's path sent up 3 distinct columns, instantly shattered into a confused mass of flying water as the charges exploded under the surface.
"Down with your helm!" called Jack,
and the aerial began to perform a languid jig, swerving, letting fly her sheets or hauling aft, diminishing and increasing her gentle pace. Never by very much, but at least enough to make sure that every fresh discharge would have to be the result of a separate calculation on the part of the Danes.
"Mr. Hyde," he said to the first lieutenant, pointing to a number of large fish that lay belly up where the shells had exploded, "let a net be put over the side. We may as well profit by the situation."
Slowly, slowly, the nearer sea moved by. The shore seemed quite motionless. Sometimes the courses and the topsails flapped, with no thrust in them, and the hands on the forecastle could be heard whistling quietly for a breeze. They had not much time for brooding, however. At 7 bells, hammocks were piped up. At 8, the men were piped to breakfast, and the pleasant smell of frying fish wafted about the deck.
"Were you ever in Elsinore, Mr. Jagiello?"
asked Jack. "Oh, many a time, sir," said Jagiello. "I know it well. I believe I could show you Hamlet's grave from here."
"I was really wondering whether they were 10- or 13-inch mortars on the upper terrace," said Jack. "But I should be very happy to see Hamlet's grave as well."
"Both 10 and 13, sir. And if you go a little to the right from the farthest turret, there are some trees. And among those trees there is the grave. You can just make out the rocks."
"So there he lies," said Jack, his telescope levelled. "Well, well, we must all come to it. But it was a capital piece. Capital. I never laughed so much in my life."
"A capital piece indeed," said Stephen, "and I doubt I could have done much better myself. But, do you know, I have never in my own mind classed it among the comedies. Pray, did you read it recently?"
"I never read it at all," said Jack. "That is to say, not right through. No, I did something better than that. I acted in it. There, the upper terrace fires. I was a midshipman at the time."
"What part did you play?"
Jack did not answer at once. He was watching for the fall, counting the seconds. At the 28th it came, well pitched up, but wide to starboard.
"Port your helm there," he called, and then went on, "I was one of the sexton's mates. There were 17 of us, and we had real earth to dig, brought from shore. It played old Harry with a deck, but by God it was worth it. Lord, how we laughed! The carpenter was the sexton, and instead of going on in that tedious way about whose grave it was, he made remarks about the ship's company. I was Ophelia, too. That is to say, one of the Ophelias."
Another salvo tore up the sea, true in line this time, but short. And as he watched, Jack caught the flash of a single mortar. Again the line was true, and he saw the shell soar to its height, soar until it was no more than a small black ball against the pale sky, then curve down, racing down, growing fast, to burst well astern.
"Judging from the height," he said, "I fancy they've reached their full elevation and their full charge."
The next salvo confirmed his judgment. The last 100 yards had carried them beyond the battery's malice, and he suggested that they too should have breakfast.
"The smell of that fish is more than I can bear," he said privately to Stephen.
At the breakfast table, with a fine view of the Narrows and the now silent Elsinore, Stephen said,
"So you were Ophelia in your youth, Captain Aubrey?"
"A part of Ophelia. But in this case the part was greater than the whole. I was called back 3 times, and the other fellows were not called back at all. Even the one that was drowned in a green dress with sprigs. 3 times, upon my honour."
"How did the poor young lady come to be divided up?"
"Why, there was only one midshipman in the flagship, pretty enough for a girl. But his voice was broke, and he could not keep in tune neither. So for the part where she has to sing, I put on the dress and piped up with my back to the audience. But neither of us was going to be drowned and buried in real earth, admiral or no admiral, so that part fell to a youngster who could not defend himself, and that made 3 of us, do you see?"
Jack smiled, his mind going back to the West Indies, where the performance had taken place, and after a while he sang,
"Young men will do it, and they come to it. By cock they are to blame." "Yes, alas, and it all ended unhappy, as I recall."
"So it did, too," said Stephen. "The pity of the world. I believe I shall go upstairs again if there is no more coffee left. I shall be sorry to miss any of the Baltic's wonders, they being, as you might say, some compensation for all the grief there is by land."
More eiders he saw, and later in the day, off the island of Saltholm, some very curious sea duck that he could not identify, that he had no time to identify, for the breeze had freshened steadily, and now the Ariel was running at 8 knots. It was vexing, but on the other hand, without this fine turn of speed, she would never have reached Falsterbo with enough light for a perfect view of a white-tailed eagle, an enormous bird in full adult plumage that plucked a fish from the sea not 20 yards from the Ariel's stern. and then again her pace meant that no flotilla of gunboats, grim but slow, would attempt her.
"I am glad to hear it," he said, when Jack told him that the ship was now well out of their range, that she was now steering to run between Bornholm and the main, and that if this breeze freshened still further, which seemed likely, they should join the Admiral in excellent time.
"I am glad to hear it, because after today's excitement I should like a long quiet night to collect my ideas, for who knows what tomorrow may bring? Bearded swans, the Phoenix himself, maybe. I shall turn in at once."
No swans of any kind. No Phoenix. A low sky, scudding cloud, a short, choppy grey sea, and the aerial tearing along under close-reefed topsails. As it increased in force, the wind veered into the west and then north of west, cutting up a sea that gave her a strong, corkscrewing motion, while at the same time she pitched violently at short, very short intervals, working so that she spewed her oakum from the nightheads to the bitts. Stephen's stomach had withstood the Atlantic, the Pacific, and the Indian Oceans, but the Baltic very nearly overcame him. He was not actually sick, but he exhibited a cold, copious salivation, a dislike for jovial company, facetiousness or merriment, and an intolerance of the notion of food. It was probably that nasty fish of yesterday, he thought. Burston-bellied fish might very well convey all manner of noxious principles. Only a fool would eat them. And only a fool would go to sea, exposing his frame to the falling damps. He kept the deck for the most part of the forenoon. There it was not so much a question of falling as of horizontal damps, for every time the Ariel plunged her head into a sea, sheets of spray and even solid water swept aft, piercing his armour at every joint, so that in time he was wet as well as cold, wet through and through.
"Perhaps I shall go and see my colleague and beg 10 drops of the sulphureous ether, or failing that, a little acid of sulphur dulcified," he said to himself. "The man is a very mere sot, but at least he has a medicine chest."
And he turned to find a quarter-deck messenger to show him the way, a jolly pink child who wore a winged cap, such being the Ariel's whim. As they went below, he heard a cry of,
"Sail ho! A cat 2 points on the starboard bow!"
But he never paused. They had sighted another sail earlier in the day, a Dane for sure, said the officers who had cruised the Baltic all last summer in the Ariel, but with infinite reluctance Jack had let her run. His business was far too urgent for him to be chasing prizes, and it would be the same with this one. In any case, Stephen was not in the least interested in a prize. All he wanted was sulphureous ether. Alas, he found the mere sot in much the same state as himself, only worse. Speechless, careless of the world, pale green, unshaven, malodorous, and what was far more regrettable, he had drunk up all the ship's sulphureous ether, and had spilt the sulphuric acid. It was now eating its way through his counterpane, but he did not mind. The sooner it ate its way through the bottom of the ship, the better, he whispered. Stephen left him in disgust, and turning on the boy who had shown him the way to Mr. Graham's cabin, he said,
"See what comes of your heathenish, superstitious custom of whistling. Your own surgeon sick, for shame. Let the captain be told that I'm retiring to meditate, and that I beg to be excused from dining."
He had not taken breakfast. He did not dine. He did not share the captain's tea. And when at last the Ariel shot into the calm waters of Karlskrona and saluted the Admiral, he felt cold, glum, and weak. So weak indeed that when Ariel's gig was alongside the flagship and he himself clambering awkwardly aboard, the man rope slipped from his hand and he fell, dropping like a sack. But Jack had prepared for this. His old friend was no seaman, never had been, and never would be a seaman. From the beginning of their acquaintance he had fallen from motionless ships and spars, motionless boats, and more than once he had even plunged between ship and boat when going up the side. Captain Aubrey had therefore given orders that the gig should hook on to the flagship as tight as a limpet, and that 2 powerful seamen should stand at the foot of the accommodation ladder
in case anyone should take a tumble.
These men, who knew very well what o'clock it was, caught Dr. Maturin's frail body as easily as a corded hammock. It weighed little more, and propelled him up the side again, urging him,
To Clapham with both hands, sir. Never say die. One more heave and we're home, safe and dry.
The captain of the fleet received them. Received them coldly, observing that the Admiral was not at leisure, and that if Ariel were to be attached to the Baltic squadron, he would thank Captain Aubrey to wear an ensign of the proper colour. Sir James had recently been promoted Vice-Admiral of the Red, which any man might have discovered by taking a little trouble. The reception was roughly what Jack had expected ever since he heard that Manby was captain of the fleet. In the course of his career, and particularly during the fierier, more undisciplined early stages of it, he had made many solid, reliable friends, and some solid, reliable enemies, Manby being one of them. Yet this disagreeable impression did not last for long. A few minutes later, a number of Swedish officers left the ship, and the Admiral's secretary, a grave young parson, showed Jack and Stephen into the great cabin, a noble room, although at present it looked more like a busy office than part of a man of war. Files everywhere, a desk covered with papers, and behind the desk a pale admiral, himself more like a jaded, work-worn minister than a sea officer. He was obviously tired, but he greeted them cordially.
"It must be years since we met, Captain Aubrey," he said, having congratulated Jack on his rapid passage.
"The last time was at Gibraltar, sir, just after your splendid victory in the Gut," said Jack.
"Yes, yes," said Sir James. "The Lord was good to us that day."
Stephen had been a spectator of that bloody affair. He thought the violent death of 2,000 Frenchmen and Spaniards an odd proof of the Lord's goodness, but he had known other able men with the Admiral's view of divine providence. During the brief interval, while Jack delivered his dispatches before introducing him, he studied Sir James's face. Grave, heavy-lidded eyes, a distinguished, earnest face, not much given to merriment. He knew Sir James's reputation as a blue-light admiral, a friend to tracts and psalms, but he had known men of the book prove most effectual men of the sword as well, and when the admiral turned to him and he caught his intelligent, penetrating, politely attentive look, he felt his heart rise. This man was no fool.
"Allow me to name Dr. Maturin, sir, who also brings you a communication from the Admiralty," said Jack. "Sir James Samaras."
"I am very happy to meet you, Dr. Maturin," said the Admiral. "I had been half expecting you, sir, and I believe I know what your letter contains. If you will forgive me, I will read it at once. Will you take a little refreshment? I always drink a glass or two of wine at this time and take a biscuit. My brother Richard recommends it. I believe you know him, sir."
This with a bow to Stephen. He rang his bell. The wine appeared on the instant, and having served the others, he retired to his desk with his glass, his dispatches, and the letter. Dick Samaras. Yes, of course Stephen knew him, though he had not made the connection. A surgeon, a tolerably good physiologist, though obstinate and wrong-headed about the ligature of the external iliac in the case of aneurysm of the femoral. Stephen thoroughly approved of his recommendation, however. The wine was champagne, a fine, fruity champagne, not too cold, and it went down very gratefully with a biscuit. He felt his weakness recede, his mind grow sharper, less gloomy, more decisive. He reflected upon the medicinal use of alcohol. He also reflected, for the dispatch was long, on Jack's expression. It was respectful, naturally enough, for not only was a vice-admiral a very much greater man than a post-captain, but Jack also entertained a sincere regard for Sir James as a man and as a most capable, resolute officer. It also had a slight resemblance to Captain Aubrey's church-going face, with just a touch of sanctimoniousness, or rather of primness, a look that sat uneasily on that red, weather-beaten, open, candid, habitually cheerful face. It was as though he were himself determined to follow the advice he had given before they set out across the harbour.
"Do not get drunk, or talk bawdy, or blaspheme, or even swear when you are aboard the flag, Stephen. The Admiral is very particular, and it will cost you a guinea every time you take the Lord's name in vain."
Jack, for his part, reflected upon the Admiral. Lord, how the poor man had aged! It was not surprising. Even as a commodore of a small squadron, Jack had been cruelly harassed by paperwork, by the responsibility for very important decisions, whose execution lay in others' hands, by the problems of cooperation with the army and with civilian authorities, by a thousand questions that had nothing to do with the running or the fighting of his ship. For the Commander-in-Chief in the Baltic, it must be very, very much worse.
"It is much as I had expected," said the Admiral, laying the letter on the dispatch. "So you are poor Mr. Ponzish's successor, sir. How I pray you may be more successful. Is Captain Aubrey aware of the nature of your mission?"
"Yes, sir."
"Then I have no doubt that you would both like to see Mr. Thornton, my political adviser. As far as I know, the situation on Grimsholm has not changed, but he has all the most recent information."
Stephen knew Thornton well, a Foreign Office man with a flair for intelligence and a singular grasp of detail. They greeted one another with the odd, ambiguous civility that had become second nature to both, betraying nothing but some degree of social acquaintance, even in spite of the present circumstances.
"Dr. Maturin has come out to take Senor Ponzish's place," said the Admiral, "and I have just told him that I know of no change in the position on Grimsholm. But I speak without the book, and I am sure you can make a more authoritative statement."
"On the island itself, there has been no material change," said Thornton. "We have two recent reports of a certain amount of discontent, caused by a lack of wine and tobacco, but it seems that Colonel Dullestret has the situation well in hand. He is popular with the garrison, and he has strengthened his authority by sending three more officers away to Danzig. But on the mainland, the French take the matter very seriously indeed. A most reliable source tells us that in spite of all his difficulties, Oudinot means to replace the Catalans by a mixed brigade of Poles, Saxons, and French. And while these are being assembled and hurried to the coast, he is sending a General Mercier, together with the former commandant, Colonel Ligier, to take control. They are to bring Dullestret the Legion d'Honneur and the offer of an independent command in Italy. On Tuesday they reach Hollenstein on their way to Gubau. It is not impossible that they have already taken ship. In the meantime, all supplies for Grimsholm have been cut off, both from Pomerania and Denmark. Apart from these reports, I have nothing new except for a more exactly detailed account of Dullestret's forces and the disposition of his guns. He has started to excavate a new battery to sweep the approaches from the mainland." He handed Stephen the list of units, territorial units whose names were as familiar to Stephen as his own. Saint-Félieu, Lorette de Mar, Palafrugel, Tossa, Saint-Père-Pescador for the sea, Empordà for the plain, Viche, Mollo, Ripoll, and many more for the mountain. There were the names of their officers, too, many of them equally familiar. He mused for a time while Jack and the Admiral studied the chart of the waters around Grimsholm, a chart with recent soundings taken from a Danish pilot, or talked to Thornton about numbers, provisions, sources of supply. In an expectant pause he said, "It appears to me that this is a situation where we must risk all at one throw, and do so at once. There is no time for deliberation. I suggest that I should be landed on the island as soon as possible, certainly before this General Mercier arrives, if he is not already there. If once I can get ashore, I feel reasonably confident of success. But I cannot think that a man of war is the best conveyance. Many of the soldiers on the island are sea Catalans, and they would recognize her at once, whatever her colors or disguise. Above all, since, as I understand, the Ariel has often appeared in the Baltic. They would blow her, or any boat belonging to her, out of the water. No, I should prefer to go in a Danzig or Danish vessel ostensibly bringing supplies. Nay, bringing supplies, in fact, for if it were loaded with the wine and tobacco that the garrison have lacked so long, my task would be sensibly lighter. No doubt, sir, you have a suitable prize?"
"I doubt it," said the Admiral. "So many foreigners are allowed to carry trade or naval stores to England under license that we take very few. And my impression is that the few we have taken this last month have already been sent in, but I will make certain."
He rang and called for an immediate report. While it was coming, Thornton spoke quietly to Stephen about the papers that Ponzish had taken with him to prove his statements, the proclamations, edicts, copies of the Moniteur, Catalan and Spanish broadsheets, even neutral publications which made it clear that the whole of Bonaparte's conduct was in complete contradiction with his promises. The atmosphere in the great cabin had become extremely grave. In the last few minutes, the attempt had taken on a living immediacy, moving from the area of general discussion and the weighing of possibilities to that of immediate action. And all those present knew that when Maturin said, "All must be risked at one throw," The all included his own life. They looked at him with some of the respect due to a corpse or a man under the sentence of death, and Jack with the deepest concern.
"I have other examples of nearly all Ponsish's documents," Stephen said. "I also have an authenticated copy of the unpublished Great Excommunication pronounced against Buonaparte by the Holy Father. Three of the gentlemen on Grimsholm are Knights of Malta, and I believe it will have a very powerful effect on them."
The report arrived. There were no Danish or Danzig prizes within a week's reach.
"I was afraid that was the case," said the Admiral. "Had you rather wait, Dr. Maturin?"
"Oh, no," said Stephen. "At this stage, a day is a year."
"If I may say so, sir," said Jack, "I believe I see a way out of the difficulty. We sighted two Danes this morning. Since I was aware that speed was of the first importance, I did not chase, but I did notice that one of them, a cat, made no attempt to escape. She carried on under courses, steering for Riga, and I make no doubt she was sailing under your license. Now, sir, the wind serves, and the weather is clearing fast. Ariel, as you know, sir, is a very fair sailor, and if I might have your permission to, as it were, suspend the cat's license, I believe I could overhaul her. She was heavy, she was slow, and I believe she was short-handed."
The Admiral considered, whistling silently.
"That is a possible solution," he said. "It is not particularly scrupulous, but necessity knows no law. On the other hand, there is the possibility of missing her and of thereby losing 2 days. The alternative is to wait until one of my cruisers picks up a Dane, licensed or not. It is more certain, but they are scattered from the Olands down to Rügen. Orders would have to reach them, and we should be obliged to pay for the certainty with time. What says Dr. Maturin?"
"I have every confidence in Captain Aubrey's ability to seize upon anything that swims," said Maturin, "and this is a situation in which I believe we must not lose a minute."
Ever since he had taken to the sea, he had been harassed by the cry, "Lose not a minute," and it gave him a certain pleasure to use it himself at last.
"Lose not a minute," he repeated, savouring the words, and went on. "As for the moral issue, are we to weigh the hypothetical inconvenience suffered by the cat against the certain death of several thousand men? For I understand that if the island cannot be induced to submit, it must be stormed."
Now that the whole process was in train, now that the long fuse had been lit, he felt a curious levity mingling with his thoughts, and he was tempted to repeat Jack Aubrey's joke about always choosing the lesser of two weevils. In most circumstances he would have done so, but there was something about Admiral Saurez, an indefinable, unaffected magnitude, that made him keep his amusement to himself. Yet for all Sir James's real dignity, Stephen did not hesitate to interrupt the technical discussion between the sailors some moments later.
"I should like to raise the point of wine and tobacco once more," he said, emerging from his thoughts. "Would it be possible, sir, to charge the Ariel with an adequate supply of these commodities, so that the eventual merchantman will in fact be found to be what she professes to be?"
"Tobacco, certainly," said the Admiral. "Wine may be more difficult, though I dare say the wardrooms of the squadron would yield a fair amount, and we could always fill up with rum, if you feel that would be suitable."
"Rum would answer tolerably well," said Stephen, "although wine would be better. And now, sir, I have some more important observations. This is clearly an expedition that must end either in complete success or in complete failure. There is little point in discussing the failure, so if you please, I will speak only of the happier event. As you are no doubt aware, I made it a condition of my stepping in that the Catalan troops on Grimsholm should not be treated as prisoners of war, and that they should be carried to Spain with arms and baggage at His Majesty's charges. It is a small price to pay for the bloodless delivery of such a fortress, I believe, and in any case I am intimately convinced that once they are in the peninsula they will at once engage on Lord Wellington's side."
"It would indeed be a trifling price," said the Admiral. "Unfortunately, I have the transports here just at hand. Mr. Ponsish made the same condition."
"Very good, very good," said Stephen. "I now come to another point. The commanders of the transports should be strongly impressed with the necessity for according the Catalan officers all the usual complements of salutes and guns and flags and so on, with all or even more than all the usual ceremony. Their position is irregular, their pride susceptible to the last degree.
the least appearance of a slight might have the most unfortunate effects. He paused. But I'm running too far ahead. Ideally, sir, the operation would proceed on these lines. The emissary is landed from the merchantman, while the aerial and the transports remain out of sight. He carries his point. After a stated interval, the aerial comes nearer to see his signal. She, in her turn, calls the transports, which come in with a body of gunners sufficiently numerous to man the batteries, and the transfer takes place at once, while the prospect of the journey home still has its full exhilarating effect, and the indignation against the French is at its height. For the sooner they are out, and the sooner the possibility of jealousies or disagreement is done away with, the better. All this may be too much to ask, but perhaps some part, at least, may be feasible.
As far as the transports are concerned, said Admiral Samaras, I see no difficulty, always providing the wind serves. For, as you know, Dr. Maturin, we are wholly tributary to the winds. If Captain Aubrey can do his part with the necessary Dane, I believe we can do ours with the troop carriers and the gunners, and indeed with the wine and tobacco that you mentioned. I fully take your point about the necessity for a very rapid transfer, and I see, sir, that the Admiralty was not at all mistaken in advising me to rely upon Dr. Maturin's sagacity.
The Admiralty was too kind entirely, said Stephen. Too indulgent by far. But to tell you the truth of it, sir, this is a conjuncture in which I had rather be granted a single small cup of luck than a whole ton of wisdom.